Okay, number 8, consumerism. Another one of those deep state tactics. They use everything. There's a history of good and bad trades. You know, I have to talk like the investment banker I am at heart. One of the worst or best trades, depending on which side you were on, was said to be the Dutch East India Company that purchased Manhattan from the Lenape Indians for 60 guilders worth of trade. And so that was said to be for trinkets. But in today's dollars, that'd be slightly more than about $1,000. So imagine selling something as priceless as Manhattan for a few trinkets. But the Dutch East India Company made a good trade there. There are various stories that follow about settlers or various militaries selling blankets to Indians that were infected with smallpox or other germs, the intimation being that it was biowarfare, which sort of in the history of good and bad trades reminds you that you want to make sure that what you're getting is really what you're getting and doesn't come with some invisible surprises. The moral of the story, of course, is buyers beware. Beware who you trade with and beware that it's not just about price. It's about whether it turns out the buyer is financing their own death, their own demise, their own trick. When you look at consumerism in recent decades, you see the use of material wealth and prosperity in a series of very, very clever ways. So I want to talk through those. In part, we are watching powerful technology and research, and again, invisible technology, applied to the management and manipulation and supply in a whole variety of different ways. So consumerism is a very complex story, and it's part of all the, you know, delicious treats or sabotage that come with the pecking order in the deep state. So let's look at some of the uses. First and foremost, consumerism in certain countries, both Europe and America, was the great attractor. With hundreds of millions of people with rising disposable income, you know, it gave those businesses, both in pretty much in the developed world, the power to attract, opening your markets to a variety of different forces, gave you, put you in the middle between sellers who wanted to sell and buyers who wanted to buy. So one was consumerism played a global attractor, and it was a way of keeping the economy going without warfare. The second is delight and distraction. Larger homes and more stuff has been part of offering citizens in the developed world a higher quality of life. And much of it truly is a higher quality of life. If you've ever had to live without a bathroom or a dishwasher or equipment to do your laundry in, you know how nice material goods can make things. There's more comfort, there's more entertainment, there's more luxury. So part is delight and distraction. Another is buying political support. So, for example, I'll use housing. Housing bought political constituencies, home builders, mortgage bankers, real estate brokers. One of the drivers was our addiction to debt and all the fees it generated and the various controls it gave. When I was in Washington, it was amazing the extraordinary number of industries and financial institutions that fed off the addiction to debt. And then cover story. So, for example, housing, and this has happened in many other industries, was really the basis, legitimate activity was the basis for massive mortgage fraud that was used to finance the black budget. The cost was enormous. It meant an enormous investment in bricks and mortar and underinvestment in human capital and way too much debt. So the use of housing as a cover story was very expensive, as we saw with the bailouts. Now, there's been a Faustian bargain in the process because what has happened over many decades in the developed world is you've seen the trading of real political power in democracies for consumer attention that makes you feel more powerful because you are getting massive attention, but you're giving up your powers, your responsibilities, your obligations in the political system, and as a result, your power is diminishing. There is an absolutely fantastic documentary that Adam Curtis did with the BBC called Century of Self. And we've reviewed it several times in Let's Go to the Movies, but I recommend it to you highly because you really see how many of us were turned from adults into sort of children being delighted with our Tinker Toys. And I go back to the story of trading Manhattan for trinkets to a certain extent, which you've seen when it comes to the trade between consumer attention and political power. You've seen people giving away that which is sacred for trinkets. I'll never forget when I really realized that. I was staying in Philadelphia with one of my best friends in the world who talk about people that you love, Georgie LaRue. And I was watching Georgie basically have a customer support fight with her cable TV and internet provider. And I suddenly realized that she was used to a massive and receiving a massive amount of attention from a whole variety of companies and expected really excellent customer service and really excellent service. She'd been in the Navy. She'd been a contract officer in the Navy. So she knew how to get performance from a big corporation. But I suddenly realized that she didn't notice her political power was diminishing because she was getting such massive attention from all the consumer providers. John Rappaport has a great interview about Columbine and the school shooting in Columbine and describing how every time people tried to figure out what had happened and sort of connect the dots, they were completely overwhelmed by a tsunami of grief counselors all trying them to get to talk about how they felt and their emotions and diverting attention away from, okay, what really happened? Let's connect the dots and do something about it. So again, political power and the power to understand and change your life was diminished by this overwhelming attention. And of course, this is attention that the big corporations have figured out how to get us to pay for or our tax dollars to pay for. I can't wait to see the massive attention. You know, if you think grief counselors can overwhelm you with a tsunami of attention, just wait till you see what a little robot R2-D2 is going to do. Part of this we've seen play out with sexual politics, especially the last round of LGBT and transgender. It's a way to get people to obsess with their self and be very creative. So humans are by nature pretty creative. And let them, rather than have them express their creativity in a democracy in terms of the governance system or the policies or the programs, have them express their creativity in all sorts of ways that obsess them with themselves and keep them away from the power lines. Brainwashing is a very important part of consumerism in many areas, particularly the United States. It's, as far as I can tell, it's by far and away much worse here than in any other place. The entrainment is very, very bad. I remember once when I was staying with Georgie in the late 90s, she was absolutely entranced with Hillary Clinton. She used to call Hillary my Hillary. And I would try and warn her about what the Clintons were doing. And she had no interest in reality. And it was clearly, she would get up in the morning and turn on the TV, and the TV would be on for most of the day. There were a massive number of drug commercials. It was astonishing. But I'm convinced that the My Hillary came from a form of entrainment, just like the entrainment I described when I had the TV connect me. I was watching a feed in the gym on the Queen's birthday. This is, I think, in about 2012, 2013, sometime in that area. And the feed went across and it said, oh, Catherine, the Queen so appreciates your, you know, being interested in her birthday, but it used my name. And which they could do because my hands were touching the pad on the treadmill. And this was a gym where it was very high tech. You use your thumb to sign in. And so I realized, oh my God, they've got this thing personalized. And of course, once the big digital screen TVs came out with the terms and conditions that allowed, you know, two-way, basically the one-way mirror to do surveillance, and that can affect what they're doing, what they're feeding back. I'm assuming both on the screen and in the entrainment. So we're talking about our paying for products, which, yes, they're entertaining. Yes, they are distracting, but also they're brainwashing us and there's no full disclosure about what's going on. Then there are consumer products that are being used for surveillance, for drugging and addicting. I'll never forget, and I'm going to use Georgie again. Georgie would faithfully take the flu shot every year. And then 1 year after they had been unable to mandate the swine flu, they decided to integrate it with a flu shot. She had been managing cancer for 10 years and seemed to have it very much under control. She took the flu shot with a swine flu shot. It destroyed her immune system and the cancer took over and she died 2 or 3 months later. And I was able to spend that 2 to 3 months with her and help her go from assisted living into a nursing home, into a hospital, into hospice. And I remember thinking, you know, she paid for the privilege of having her immune system destroyed. And I truly believe the commercials that were being digested day in and day out had something to do with it. So here you are once again financing the surveillance, financing your own drugging, financing your own addiction. It happens to all of us, but if we can be conscious of it, it's amazing how much we can do to make sure we're getting what we think we're paying for. I bring up the example of the Impossible Burger at Burger King, which I now refer to as the Biowarfare Burger. I published a link to a doctor from South Dakota who described that the Impossible Burger has 18 million times more estrogen in it than the Whopper Burger, famous at Burger King, which means if you regularly take your children to Burger King, your little boys are getting the equivalent of hormone replacement therapy, if what I understand is true. Robin O'Brien was a food analyst at a very prominent Wall Street firm, and she retired to raise kids and discovered her kids were getting sicker and sicker. And so she investigated and discovered the explosively deteriorating quality of food from the mid-1990s on. If you haven't watched some of her talks, we have them up on the website. But if you just do a general search and start with her TED Talk, she shows you the fact that you as a consumer are buying these products, and at the same time, you are buying yourself into sickness. In other words, you are really the target of an experiment and biowarfare. So there's not full and fair disclosure of what it is you think you're buying, and you're not able to price it accurately because you don't know what it is. That's why there's been such a big row over labeling in the United States. And unfortunately, if you look at what the labeling laws are doing, they're nowhere near what the consumers want. Finally, social media. There's a great link that we have up, a recent Dutch documentary interviewing Shoshana Zuboff on surveillance capitalism. We're paying to be spied on. We're paying for other people to create control files that they can use to control us. If you look at all these different appliances that you bring into your home full of digital equipment, such as Nest and Alexa, these things are very, very, very dangerous, especially because the information can be used not to control you using information that's true, but it can be used to falsify and trump up things. So again, we're paying. It's profitable to be the spy. We need a clear mind and healthy body. And when consumer products are weaponized against us, it becomes more and more complicated and harder to do that. One of the reasons I love spending half of my year approximately in Europe is I don't feel like I'm running a gauntlet. In America, it's much trickier. It's much more dangerous. There's a wonderful documentary called Terms and Conditions about the fact that if we honestly read the terms and conditions for the software and products we used, we would have to spend 3 months a year just reading terms and conditions. So part of this is the game has been made very complex and time-consuming to navigate. One of the questions is, why don't we shun the bad guys? Somebody gave me a statistic the other day saying that JP Morgan Chase has approximately 50% of the people in America as a customer, whether they have an account or a credit card. I can't for the life of me understand why anybody would be, you know, feel safe giving their data to JP Morgan Chase or having a relationship. It's one of the reasons why on the ESG wrap-up, we did an insert that literally shows you, you have to see it printed out. It's amazing. You can open the link and download it, or if you're a premium subscriber, you get the hard copy. But we have a whole booklet, page after page after page, showing you $43 billion of settlements for illegal or unethical activities of JP Morgan Chase. You'll be stunned if you read it. At the end, our graphic artist put this picture of an owl with the definition of the word flabbergasted. It's pretty funny. If you have an account at JP Morgan Chase, I can't imagine why you feel safe. But it wasn't that long ago. I just went around and around with a subscriber kept telling me, well, my account's not big. My account's not important. No, your account is big. Your account is important. And it's interesting. One of the things they said to me when they switched out and got to a good community bank is, wow, I feel so much better. Anyway, I've noticed, you know, because I've gone through a process where I've purged a lot and you feel better and better. So I told the story when I talked about Brand of, in fact, this is one of my favorite people in the world saying, why is nobody doing anything? They're always saying, why is nobody? So what do you mean nobody's doing anything? And this is when they first said it was about the housing market, I said, look at what I'm doing. Look at what you're doing. You know, and she said, well, but you're nobody. You're not somebody. I said, wait a minute. I was the assistant secretary of housing. I was a partner of a major Wall Street firm. You know, I have all these credentials. If you go look at my resume, blah, 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 blah. And she said, oh, well, you used to be somebody, but now you're nobody. And what I finally got out of her was the only people who are considered to be somebody are the people promoted by the people who are trying to kill us or steal from us. So if the only people you admire are the people who are promoted by organized crime, then guess what's going to happen? If you allow your heroes to be defined by the people who are stealing from you, you've got a problem. But it's your problem, and you have the power to fix your problem. It's one of the reasons we have a hero every week on the Solari Report and a hero of the year on the Solari Report, because there are tons of great people doing great things, you know, in the general population, in the leadership, in the deep state, all over the place. Great people. More often than not, they're the ones that, you know, they don't get held up as celebrities, because a lot of the celebrities and the quote unquote heroes are really Judas goats. The Judas goat is the goat you get to walk the whole herd into the slaughterhouse. Anyway, so one of the things we got to think about is why are we financing for-profit surveillance of ourselves, for-profit drugging of ourselves, for-profit addicting of ourselves, for-profit brainwashing of ourselves? We have the power to fix this, and that's the good news when it comes to consumerism. Anyway, it's very important to think very clearly about what material goods you want, how you use them, how you get them, and ensure that they come with full disclosure. That's the important thing. Full disclosure, because full disclosure gives you the ability to price something accurately and to shun it. And shunning, again, is one of the most powerful cultural and political forces on the planet. I've been a long-term subscriber to Consumer Reports, which I think is an excellent service. And it's quite good on many products, particularly products that aren't controversial. There are many reputable companies making many fine products. Now, to a certain extent, we need a Consumer Reports for the real deal, because they don't understand a lot about the covert side. So, you know, they're good at protecting us for some things, not others. So someday we're going to have to create a capacity to do that. One of my favorite Netflix series I talked about in Let's Go to the Movies is Tidying with Marie Kondo, who's the Japanese sort of organization consultant who has a very successful book on how to tidy up your home. And in the series, she goes into different homes throughout America and helps people clean out their stuff and get organized and downsize from so much stuff. When you see how much stuff people have, it's absolutely frightening. And what you realize is this was you're talking about a level of consumerism which is extremely unhealthy and dangerous. It's almost like a sport, and it's consumption is a sport, buying things you don't need and overwhelming and stuffing up your house. It's really very unhealthy. And it reminds me, in the early 90s, I went to dinners for several evenings at Imelda Marcos's house when she was renting Doris Duke's brownstone in New York. And one night I was sitting at dinner with Imelda, and she turned to me and she said, "Would you like to see my shoes?" I said, "Oh yeah, I'd love to see your shoes." So she took me upstairs and opened the closet. And remember, this is just a temporary rental. So she's in Doris Duke's brownstone for a couple of years in New York. I've never seen so many shoes in my life, even in a shoe store. And they were beautiful. Woman had incredible taste. I have to say, she wore beautiful shoes, but it was truly a sight to behold. And the reality is, we don't need that many shoes. Litigation, 11 years of litigation that was extremely, sort of like an extreme survival experience, really changed my relationship with things. My possessions were weaponized against me. Every time I left Hickory Valley, I would come back and one thing of either sentimental value or financial value would be gone. And I studied the pattern, and it turns out that's a very common pattern that is used by the deep state against people in that situation. And when I realized what was happening, it's funny, when I make a command decision, I just go to it. I made a list of everything that had sentimental or financial value, and I gave it away over the next year. That's what my sister got a Renoir for Christmas. It was kind of funny, but I just boom, 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 boom. I said, nobody is going to use my possessions as a weapon. I had some very valuable family antiques going back to the 1600s that came over, on the boat. And I was lucky, I had a wealthy uncle who was nice enough to buy them all from me at appraised value. And then when the litigation was over, he said, "Would you like to buy them back?" Because I got a fair amount of the money that Hamilton was owed back. And I said, "No, I can't afford to have valuable possessions. I can't afford to have a valuable house. I don't want any material thing of any value anymore, because I want to be free to do what I do." I knew doing the Salieri Report, I didn't want to have to worry about that. And I really felt that it would become a conflict of interest. And my home, I talked about this early in the deep state. I had very beautiful homes, both in New York and Washington, and it became a real issue. People would get jealous. It just became an issue. And I said, okay, I don't want that issue in my life. If that's going to be a sort of a competitive issue with the boys in the deep state, I don't need to have anything of value. So I kept downsizing. I gave everything away. A couple relatives died, so I picked some more stuff up, but there was a shredding process. I remember when I sold my house in Washington, it took us 2.5-3 years to kind of sell everything. We got on eBay and just sold. And on one part, it was hard because there were so many beautiful things I absolutely loved. But on the other hand, I wanted to be free, and I wanted to be free to do what I do with clarity and purpose, and not, every time I post a controversial story, think, oh God, they're going to burn the house down. So so I got the smallest possible house in a very modest place. I decided to stay in Hickory Valley, which is one of the places I was living in my nomadic period. And my only complaint is there's not enough room for the books, which I do keep buying. There's a wonderful scene in World War Z with Brad Pitt that I've pointed out many times, and the Brad Pitt character. is telling somebody that when you're in these kinds of disaster experiences, the people who make it are the people who move. And then he says, movement is life. And I believe that. I never, when the litigation was over, I never said, I want to find a new home, a new place. I want to go away and find a place where it's safe. Now, I do believe that there are places in the world that are safer than the United States. But I also believe what we're dealing with is global. And I want to be able to move and rock and roll. So it's one of the reasons for a somewhat nomadic lifestyle. And I try and keep things light. One of my favorite lines is from the 2,000-year-old man. Carl Reiner is interviewing the 2,000-year-old man. And he says, he asks him the places in the world he likes. He says, I like Europe. I keep a locker in Europe. And I'm headed to the Netherlands on next Friday. And I'm delighted to say I have a bit of a locker in Stavoren, so I don't have to carry everything with me. The Lawrence Gonzalez wrote one of my favorite books. It's in the best books for 2020. It's called Deep Survival. And there's a wonderful interview in the library with Lawrence on that book and his subsequent book. One of the things he did was he interviewed people who had experienced extreme survival challenges in the wilderness and lived. And the book is all about, you know, what are the behaviors that cause people to survive extreme survival experiences. And it's very relevant to day-to-day living. You can learn a lot. It's one of my favorite books. Anyway, a lot of great insight, a lot of great advice. But one of the things he learned when he went back and wrote a book about, okay, what happens to people who survive these experiences, you know, 2, 3, 5, 10 years later, one of the things he discovered is they all have an unquenchable thirst to travel and see the world. So there you have it. I'd much rather travel and see the world, and I don't want to have to be worried about things and taking care of things. And if I'm not hovering over my things, something will go wrong. Anyway, in a world which is going through profound change and where the rule of law does not protect property rights, you know, I want to be free to rock and roll. One of the seminal moments at the end of Hamilton Securities before I closed it down is the sort of number two in equity holder at Hamilton, who I'd worked with for many, many years, said to me, look, we have very, very valuable software. Let's just take the software tools and go make money. And I said, no, the software tools are meaningless. People are what have value. And, you know, it's almost like the universe split. And Carlyle financed him starting a company with some people. And I think, you know, their behavior towards me was not completely honorable. And meantime, the DOJ, the Department of Justice, came hard after Hamilton. And I stood in the breach and protected lots and lots of people, which was exactly the right thing to do. I have no regrets whatsoever. I did exactly the right thing. And if you look at what was going on in Washington, that was when the country took a very hard wrong turn when we assassinated Kennedy, but we took another very hard wrong turn when we decided to play the private prison game and genocide in poor neighborhoods. So we live in a world surrounded by delicious things, and I'm always somebody who's enjoyed my wealth when I had it, and I was surrounded by beautiful things. My houses were beautiful, my clothes were beautiful, my cars were beautiful. I still, to this day, have a lot of my old French Parisian suits. One of the things that really irritated me as a young woman was listening to my Quaker family and teachers rail against consumerism. For some reason, you know, consumerism was to blame for everything. Meantime, they were silent about CIA drug trafficking, you know, CIA mind control, pedophilia. I always found it a bit much. I could never understand why consumerism by honest people was a big problem when organized crime was something we pretended wasn't happening. And so, you know, I kind of felt the world was divided between, you know, if you worked for organized crime, you'd live a nice life. If you worked for the good guys, you know, you had to be deprived. Anyway, I didn't want to miss out on the Hermes scarf. So I've really experienced the deliciousness of trinkets, but I've also experienced the deliciousness of them weaponized to trick, harm, addict, or tie down. So that's why I say think strategically about your relationship with things and make sure you're serving your free and inspired life. And if that means buying, you know, a beautiful Hermes scarf, great. But if it means buying something that sends a data stream back to the deep state to build your control file, maybe you want to think twice about that. Tyranny is bad, but buying it and bringing it into your home is a bit over the top. I used to always use, and still do sometimes, the metaphor of a tapeworm. The way a tapeworm works in your body, it injects into you a chemical that makes you crave what's good for the tapeworm and bad for you. And the trick of, so the key to a tapeworm is understanding that you feed the tapeworm in a way that kills yourself. You are participating, just like we are participating when we bank with JP Morgan Chase, in feeding the tapeworm that's killing all of us. You know, there is a codependent relationship between the host and the tapeworm, and the tapeworm's power, because the tapeworm is clearly tiny compared to the host, clearly doesn't begin to have the skills, the resources that the host has. And yet the tapeworm wins because they inject a chemical that makes the person crave what's good for the tapeworm. And if you look at a lot of media and entertainment and digital technology, it comes with the injection. And so when you think strategically about consumerism, beware the injection, and beware the injection getting you to participate in consumerism in a way which is bad for your health, bad for your pocketbook, bad for your mind, and bad for your political power. Anyway, so it's exceptionally important that you kill the injection. So that's it for parts 6 through 8 of Deep State Tactics 101. Next week, I'm going to cover the remaining topics, cybersecurity, covert operations and crime, targeting of children, the beatdowns, company, neighborhood, cohort. Then I'll talk about hard times, my list of the personal worst, a little bit on helpful strategies. I'm going to start publishing Take Action 2020 as soon as I get the state of our currency off to the printer. So Take Action 2020 is where we're really going to deep dive. And then finally, my closing thoughts. So until then, please remember, don't ask if there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.